Hello, and welcome to the This Month in Forensics podcast for June 2018. I'm Phil Moore, and here's a few things from the last month that I wanted to talk about. Of course, this isn't everything. The industry puts out a massive amount of content every week, and it seems to be getting more and more, which is great. So for everything that I can find, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. We'll start with a few tool updates. Eric Zimmerman has updated a number of his tools, and the main mention here goes to his MFT parser. During Eric's research, he identified a couple of major bugs in the sleuth kit. So even though others have called it a solved problem, it's good to have another set of eyes go over it every once in a while. And by all accounts, Eric's tool works really well. Velexity have released a new memory acquisition tool called Surge Collect. It's a paid product, and haven't got any ideas of the cost, but apparently it works quite well as well, which is always good to hear. Elcomsoft released Elcomsoft PhoneBreaker 8.3, adding the ability to remotely access iMessage conversations stored in an iCloud account. And they say it becomes the first forensic tool on the market to extract encrypted iMessage conversation histories from the cloud. Last mention I wanted to give for software updates was the Get Data Updated Forensic Explorer and added some Mac artifact automatic parsing as well as other improvements. And the reason why it's worth mentioning is because not a lot of tools will automatically parse out Mac artifacts. So it's good to give them a shout out for that. And a lot of other tool updates and a lot of tool releases. But let's move on to something that's got a lot of people talking recently. So the news that everyone's been talking about for the last kind of month is the hidden API in Office 365. This provides access to mailbox activities for all users for the last 6 months. And a number of firms have been using it as kind of competitive advantage. It all came to a head at the Forensic Summit where an anonymous style video was released identifying it as the Activities API. Shortly after this, CrowdStrike released a post describing the API, and they released a Python module to access the data. For a really good overview of the history, Sherry Davidoff at LMG Security walked through what's happened, and they also released a wrapper script built around that CrowdStrike module. And it was also kind of an interesting debate that happened on the SANS DFIR listserv about the ethics of the release because of the way that it was released and the way it all came out and whether people should share things earlier and all of that. It's kind of interesting. If you're on the listserv, go check it out. There's a lot of emails and a lot of arguing to and fro, which is fun. Right, Matt at Bit of Hex shared some use cases of for CyberChef, which is an open source tool maintained by GCHQ. It's been around for a little while, but it's got some really good inbuilt features, and it can be run offline or you can use the online version. And Matt shows a few of these functions, but it's really just the tip of the iceberg for its usefulness. Ladrina at Arsenal Consulting shows some of the testing that she did on quick look databases on macOS. Which can be really useful to show files on the system. I think that she showed that certain files will provide their full path even though the files haven't been accessed. So it's really good for, say, files copied off an external drive or onto an external drive, rather. You might be able to see the full path of those files, including their name, even if they haven't been opened, which is great. Dave Cohen has started up his daily blogging again. And has been focusing a lot of his time on his testing of extended MAPI data. As a result of Dave kind of pushing everyone forward a bit, a bunch of other daily bloggers have started up. A few kind of started and then stopped, but the stragglers that have kept it going have been Stacey Randolph at The Knowledge Bean and Tony at Archer Forensics. I'm going to take credit for that name. So Stacey's been covering a lot of mobile and Mac stuff at the moment, and Tony's been spending his early posts on the soft skills of traveling and getting into the field. And lots of exciting stuff going forward from both of them, as well as Dave, as usual. Dave also posted an article by Nicole Ibrahim on her work into event tracing logs, which she presented at the SANS Summit. I don't know much about the ETL logs, but from the post they look really useful and contain a wealth of information, so it's worth checking that out. From my research perspective, on my ThinkDFR page, I wrote a quick post about zone identifiers and how not all zone IDs are created equally. Some will give you the usual expected zone ID equals 3, and then others, like Chrome, for example, will give you the full path from where the file was downloaded from. So I did a bit of testing and showed, what I could find with the browser I had on my Windows 10 machine. And then Jacko at the Swanepoel Method took that research and ran with it, confirming what I'd found and adding a bit of extra information. And then after that, Dave decided to put it up as a challenge on Sunday Funday, which really allowed me to dive deeper into it and test a number of different ways that you can create Zono Days, which, previously I thought the Zono Day would only come down from a browser, but obviously the application can decide to check to set the alternate data stream. There's nothing really that says it has to be a browser. So you'll find it in Office 365, apparently SharePoint stuff, as well, Windows Mail, Skype. There's plenty more things to test. My suspicion is that a lot of the Microsoft apps will set them, but really it needs to all be kind of collated together and thoroughly tested if it's of interest and importance to people. Oleg at CyberForensicator has also shared his answer for the Sunday Funday challenge, and eventually we will, like I just said, need to combine it all together because everyone kind of tested different things, and they've either confirmed what others have found or found other situations that others didn't test, which is good to see. Jacko again at the Swanepoel Method shares some command line stuff that he was working on to get some answers quickly regarding failed logon attempts in Windows event logs. I like this kind of approach because you can get answers really quickly while you do the kitchen sink approach. So in this instance, he set log to timeline running, and obviously that's going to go off and take forever to run on a large image with volume shadows and all of that. And in the meantime, he found he was able to get a lot of information very quickly, in 5 minutes, I think it was, on some of the questions that he had. So it's kind of good to do both if you have the opportunity. Like I do like to set the kitchen sink running and then extract some specific artifacts and get some answers on the board really as quickly as I can. Cool. Dave has opened up the Magnet CTF site so you can play along at home. So the Magnet User Summit was end of last month, and there was a CTF that ran, which was great fun. It's a really good learning experience, and as a result, they have opened up the site to allow other people to do it. There's 25 to 30 questions on a Windows memory and disk image, and as a result, the CTF is open. The challenge images have been uploaded. Jessica at Magnet has uploaded the processed Axiom case as well. So there's really a lot kind of going for it. You don't have to use Axiom. Obviously, it was for the Magnet CTF, so that's going to be used for a lot of the answers, but you can obviously do it in any tool you want. Some of the questions, I think, don't work with Axiom yet, so keep that in mind. But yeah, it's worth doing. It's worth testing yourself and just seeing how you go. And if you can write up your answer, explain how you did it, that's always good to see. The download was huge. I think it was a total like 40 to 50 gig. You might have to set a bit of time to pull that down depending on your internet speed. The SANS Summit, DFR Summit, was run at the beginning of the month, and so all the presentation slides have been released for that. For those that weren't there, you can go through the actual presentations won't be released for another month, I think, maybe 6 to 8 weeks. But in the meantime, you can flip through the slides. For my presentation, I presented on Google Home stuff, how you should go about interacting with them, obtaining data, say you come across one during a warrant or as part of a case. And I wrote a blog post on ThinkDFR explaining the tool that I wrote that you can use to query Google Homes directly with the web API. I don't know how many people are seeing Google Homes or are coming across them in their investigations, but it's good to kind of get out ahead of these things because this kind of stuff isn't going away. Obviously, Alexa's around a bit longer, but people are picking up Google Homes because they're very cheap, so we might start seeing the wealth of data that can be obtained. Also, at the summit was the Forensic Forecast Awards. Unfortunately, I didn't win. I was one of the people that was put up for the Blog of the Year. And Forensic Focus took that Blog of the Year spot again. I would like to get some feedback on how I can improve the site. I'm not really sure, what I can do. What people that voted for Forensic Focus are finding that more useful than my site. Obviously, I'm not going to disparage them. They've won, I think, 3 years in a row now, so people, you know, clearly find their blog useful. I just want to know what I can do better to provide a better resource for the community, obviously. Because I do find that when I speak to people, the people that do know about the site, you know, love it. But obviously, that's not everyone. I would like to get more people viewing it. Hopefully, will help make it even better for the community. Lee did ask for feedback about the awards. So obviously, if you've got some thoughts about that, if you even care about the Forecast Awards, I know a lot of people do. You should hit him up and let him know what your thoughts are and how it can be improved. There are kind of people that win it every year and never come and collect their awards. There are people that, you know, win it every year in an almost uncontested category, and it's, you know, does that really work towards what Lee envisaged when he set up the awards about, you know, recognizing people in the field for doing good work? So obviously reach out to Lee about that if you have thoughts. But also, and I'll have to put the link in the show notes for it, Lee made an amazing video that is well worth watching to commemorate the, I think it's the 10th year that he's run the awards. Definitely worth seeing. If you don't care about anything else, that video was fantastic. Lastly, I'm going to finish on the topic of sharing research. This is my 12th episode, I think. And I probably talk about sharing in every single one, so you feel free to skip this part. There's been a lot of people talking about research and covering the whole sharing of research, more from a formal aspect than people starting blogs, but talking more about academic research and journal articles. So there's quite a few posts to read about that, a lot of them coming out of DFAI training, because Brett clearly has a lot of thoughts about it. So a few people have listed out the issues that they see and their solutions. And currently, I think the proposed solution is called rapid peer review, which is the brainchild of Jess Hyde and then also kind of posted by Brett on DFR training. As a result, Joshua James at DFR Science suggested that this doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And he proposed to use the open journal system instead. And he's got a fairly extensive post covering all the different, I guess, stakeholders that have to do with posting research from an academic point of view and a practitioner point of view and a reviewer and all of the different people involved. Personally, I think the major issue is the time taken to produce papers compared to the actual benefit that is received by the person that wrote it or even the reviewer that reviews it. So my understanding is that academia is required to publish in reputable journals, and then they need competent reviewers to go over their work. And the problem that I've heard about here is that the reviewers aren't necessarily getting compensated, which means it's hard to incentivize people to do it. Similarly, if you're not in academia, what is really the benefit in posting a research article in a journal, potentially up to a year after you could have just put it on a blog or posted an article on your website? It does get you that kind of, you know, you can say you've been published in journals or people can cite it, but whether that's of importance to the practitioners is kind of questionable. And so does that mean that the side of academia is just writing articles for the sake of writing articles, not necessarily ones that are incredibly useful? Personally, I know I read, you know, all of the blogs that I can find. I don't necessarily read all the journal articles. But that could say more about me, or it could say that there needs to be more value found in some journal articles saying, you know, you need to read this because. My two cents, which I guess is this whole podcast, so disregard that, is that, you know, academia needs to be taking things that have already been done and formalizing them, rather than chasing after the new hotness, some random investigation method that maybe someone might use. I don't really, as I said, read journal articles very often, and I kind of would like to see more articles that really drill into a topic, they do a literature review and extensive testing and really cover it, you know, really deeply. And that's something I think that we need more of, so that we can say, say the zone identifiers paper, is here is everything that we tested, here's everything we know about it, here's the paper that you can read if you need to get up to speed on the current state of this specific artifact. So yeah, I mean, that's just my thought, and it'd be interesting to see where this conversation goes. I think there's also a presentation up for voting at OSDFCon about research, so I'm interested to see if that gets selected, whether what the author of the presentation, who I think I know who it is, has to say about it, because that could be very interesting. And that's it for this month. Of course, this isn't everything. Everything I've found, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. I wanted to give a shout out to my Patreons and now PayPal donor, I guess I've only got one. So for the people that have gotten a bit of value out of my work and want to give a little bit of value back to me, there's the Patreon and the PayPal. So thanks a lot to you guys. It really helps motivate and incentivize me to keep going, pretty much, because you know I obviously do this all in my free time. For those that are interested, the Patreon supporters and PayPal people, I guess, will also get the links that I've mentioned as well as the time code, so it makes it a bit easier to look things up. So thanks to everyone that have pledged. If you've got suggestions or recommendations, you can let me know on Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find. I'm at Phil Moore, and I spend way too much time there. Special thanks to my friend Jeff, who's Animatic on SoundCloud, for letting me use his track. And thanks for listening.